Welcome to Ouch Hello, the show which aims to share far too much about our lives as disabled people. I'm Rob.
And I'm Kate. On this edition, we'll be meeting a man whose aim is to get into the Rio Paralympics next year. He only started with his sport, cycling, 2 years ago, and the year before that, he was serving time in prison.
Now, eating disorders are something that rightly or wrongly we usually associate with women. We'll be meeting a man who says that living with cerebral palsy led him to developing anorexia.
And will disabled people be allowed to use driverless cars? As more automatic cars are announced and rumours that Apple has one in development, two guests will be helping us look beyond the technology and predict whether driving licences will be available to everyone.
Music too, and the quiz. Stay tuned.
Ouch! Disability Talk from the BBC with Rob Crossan and Kate Monaghan.
We've got four guests this month. Let's say hello to Ryan Branson first. Hello, Ryan.
Hello, how are you?
Now, you're the man who's had anorexia that we mentioned at the top of the show. Now, airbrush models are often blamed for giving young women low self-esteem and eating disorders. Is that different for men?
I would say so. I mean, men are subjected to, you know, look more muscular, where women, I would say they're more stereotyped to look, you know, really thin. So there still is that stigma within the media that men really don't care about their appearance, but that's just not true.
Well, we'll go into that a little bit later. And now, Craig Green, hello.
Hello.
Now, you're our Paralympian hopeful. We'll talk to you later about your achievements since being released from prison in 2012. Now, you've got Poland syndrome, haven't you, where that's where your chest muscles and right hand are underdeveloped. So, I mean, tell me if I'm wrong, but I imagine when you were in prison, your fellow inmates, I mean, did you get a hard time because you looked slightly different?
Not particularly, no. There might have been the odd stare, but nothing out of the ordinary.
When you say the odd stare, do you mean a hostile stare or just a curious stare?
Bit of both, really. It depends how you want to take the stare. There is two different stares. There's a curiosity and then there's a rude stare. I mean, I prefer to be asked than stared at.
Yeah. How did you interpret these stares then?
Depend how big they were.
cautiously.
Yeah, cautious. I mean, I just got on with things, really. And I suppose a bit later on we'll get into that.
Well, indeed, we will get into that later on. But first, we're going to talk about driverless cars. They've been on the horizon for a few years now. Google's famous Street View car has driven 700,000 miles without an accident, but more crucially, without a person controlling it. Companies like Tesla, Peugeot, Mercedes are now revealing partially automated cars, which allow you to let go of the wheel on motorways. And some vehicles are also able to park themselves.
In fact, a lot of people do let go of the wheel on motorways anyway. Not that I approve of this, but I have seen it.
Yeah. That is not possible.
Anyway, go on.
The technology is well on the way, and there are rumours that Apple and Virgin are about to throw their hat in the ring too. It's an exciting prospect for people who presently can't drive due to disability. But will lawmakers and the general public accept that it's safe for disabled people to travel alone in a computer-driven car if they can't take the wheel in an emergency?
Now, to help us discuss this, and I must say this is something which personally to me I'm incredibly excited about, we have AbilityNet's Robin Christofferson, and we have Hugh Hoddy, who works in policy for a disability charity. Hello to you both.
Hi.
Now, Robin, you currently can't drive. Now, where would you go if someone gave you the keys to a driverless car right now? Where would you go?
Yeah, so I'm blind and it would be a dream of mine after, you know, using public transport for several decades now, to be able to just go door to door anywhere. I don't care where. I might even just cruise around to begin with.
We're not talking driving to Paris. We're talking literally going to Aldi or a supermarket.
Who knows? Just to have the option.
And same question to you, Hugh. Where would you go right now if I were to give you the keys to the driverless car of your dreams?
I have no idea. I at this stage, I have to say, I think I'd walk.
You'd reject the keys.
Yeah.
I'm taking back the hypothetical keys and clutching them closer to my bosom.
Yeah, but I'd sell it. Why would
you walk when you have such a, you know, bizarre and amazing and potentially exciting, safe piece of technology?
I don't think it's exciting. It's a car.
Now, you're visually impaired, aren't
yeah.
you?
Yeah. Well, I was visually impaired by the time I got to the point of being at school. You know, my mates were getting provisional driving licences. I couldn't. And I felt that emotional pain of seeing my peers sort of almost a rite of passage, moving to being a proper guy. Driving is very strongly associated with masculinity and with independence. For men, it's a sense it's you have to be independent, whereas perhaps things could feel a bit different in those days. I mean, this was 20 years ago.
But also, I mean, I'm thinking, just because I went through this exact experience myself, I remember the pain and humiliation my friends who didn't pass first time or didn't pass second time went through, and I was so happy that I didn't have to get into that challenge. And secondly, the other thing was, because I'm not driving, it means I can just drink however much I like at the pub. Did you not find these sort of compensatory factors, you know, appealing to
no,
you?
No, I didn't. I wasn't into drinking much because I was a really keen cyclist, oddly, in those days with the remaining vision I had. I wanted to become a really great hill cyclist. It was pie in the sky. It was never going to happen, but it was fantastic exercise, and it meant that for those years that I had enough vision to be able to ride my own bike. Mm. I rode a bike instead of driving, and I rode in the Peak District. And so I was on my own. I was able to just cycle on my own. So I suppose that's an important thing that I have experienced, manoeuvring my own vehicle, you know, albeit a bicycle, along the road. So perhaps my need to drive was partially met by that.
Mm. Now, Robin, obviously we've heard now that Hugh really doesn't have an interest in a driverless car. I mean, what about you? I mean, do you really think that this is something which potentially could change people's lives? And if so, how?
Absolutely. I mean, all of the people with a variety of disabilities for whom driving is either difficult or impossible would benefit greatly. But, you know, this isn't a disability-specific project, so the insurance industry are incredibly excited by this, and there's already noises about them giving lower premiums to people that have autonomous capabilities within cars, and also autonomous vehicles in general, you know, fully autonomous vehicles, will attract lower insurance as well. And this is something that is addressing a huge problem. I mean, 90% of the time we're not using our car, so it's just sitting in the driveway or somewhere, you know, car park somewhere, taking up space. 30% of inner city traffic is just cars circling looking for a parking space. So there are very definite congestion and car sharing needs that are going to be met by this. But more than that, it's just something that would really, I mean, it might even revolutionise sort of car ownership. You would literally just call one. So Uber, for example, which is a private car taxi company in the States, in the UK and elsewhere in Europe, which just uses an app on a smartphone. The iPhone version of it is very accessible, so blind people utilise this a lot. To be able to call a car, admittedly driven by somebody at the moment, but that capability to be extended to autonomous vehicles would be incredibly powerful.
So it seems that a lot of the technology is definitely already there, but it's very hard for me to imagine in my lifetime that Britain's motorways are going to be full of blind and visually impaired people like me reclining in the back of their car with an iced tea whilst being ferried automatically to Dumfries. I don't know why I said Dumfries. I don't want to go to Dumfries. But do you really think it's going to happen?
Absolutely. So we've already seen concept cars by Mercedes, for example, where there's no steering wheel and all the seats swivel and there are screens all around the place and it's basically like a living room on wheels. And
give us a date. When are we going to see these on the road? You had to be Nostradamus here.
I'll tell you the smoking gun from an evidence point of view is the fact that Google Ventures, so that's the venture capitalist arm of Google, have invested $258 million in Uber that I mentioned before to autonomise their vehicles so that they don't have to pay drivers. Mm. And they're going to be funding a fleet of 25,000 taxis. Now, if you think about it, the whole raison d'etre of that is that you can call one. And if you can call one, it has to be able to drive autonomously. And you have to be able to get into it. And I'm pretty
positive. Yeah, but you still haven't said when.
Okay. I think that, well, we know that this technology is mature. The only, you know, it's legal in three states in America. There are road tests here in the UK. The only issue at the moment is with snow and rain, which is why the three states in America have very little of that, if none. And that's not going to be too much longer in the pipeline, according to, you know, the evidence in the tech press. I would, at the very earliest, I would say 2 to 3 years. At the very latest, I would say 2020.
2 to 3 years? You really think?
I got to step in. 2025. 2025, 2030. There's a reason for this. If you read the Department for Transport's pathway document to driverless vehicles, there's some really key things here which Robin's not really covered. Liability for who's responsible in the event of an accident. I know it's been said that these cars drive for 700,000 miles without an accident. Well, they've got a driver in them. They're not intervening with the vehicle, but they're not driving autonomously with no driver. They're driving with a driver who's responsible legally for the safety of the vehicle. So that's really important. Human beings are still very much in the liability position in these vehicles. And so the fundamental things that are going to have to be done by the industry to make it possible for this, let's define the goal as a visually impaired person rings up one of these cars, steps out their door, steps into it, and then goes to their destination. If that's what we're aiming for, that is a human used vehicle. It is not driven by a person, and that's the latter stages of the implementation of driverless vehicles.
Well, it's quite a comprehensive litany of points there that Hughes made. So, Robin, I mean, this is the nub. I mean, if you can't see well enough to override the computer, the automated vehicle, to avoid an accident, or if you don't have the ability to physically steer, should you need to go analog, let's say, I mean, no one's ever going to license disabled people to drive, surely. I mean, how would you respond to that?
You can't imagine having to click a disclaimer in the Uber app before you can get in the car, which says that, you know, I will sit in the driver's seat, I will have my hands poised on the steering wheel, I will be watching at all times, just in case I have to grab it and wrestle it out of the control of the computer. You know, the technology is very mature. There's all these different sensors. It's crunching 750 gigs worth of data every minute. From an audit trail or an evidence point of view, the insurance company are very excited, the insurance industry, because it's conclusive data to show who was at fault. So as far as an autonomous vehicle being involved in an accident, you know, there'll be no doubt at all which party was at fault. And if it was the car, if it was the software, then those few occasions when that is at fault, then the insurance company would foot the bill. Otherwise, it would be the other bloke.
I can see he's gagging to come back in here.
There's so much.
I'll let you vent spleen for a moment.
There's so much in this that is just not tested. You know, the insurance companies are showing interest, but I tell you what, we've just been talking about using these as taxes. Well, the insurance industry want to make money out of this. Any self-respecting commercial company wants to make money out of this. And this is the heart of what is going to become of our ability as VI people to use these things for getting around. At the moment, there's perfectly good buses in big cities. There's an excellent taxi service, local taxi service that I use. I don't pay the insurance companies any money for this, so I'm not one of their customers. So I can't see how they make money out of me, but they'll make money on my next-door neighbour. At the moment, insurance companies are only showing interest in this because it's going to increase their profits and lower their having to shell money out on accidents. 90% of accidents, according to DFT, are caused by human error. And they're saying, well, these driverless vehicles are going to wipe that out. OK, if that's true, let's face it, there's hardly been any testing compared to the total number of journeys made by human beings every year. It's just a fraction of all those journeys. And, you know, let's be honest, the money just won't follow VI people. It will follow where they're making the money, and that is...
You say vehicles VI, you mean
visually impaired people. Yeah. And I think the money to invest in all of this stuff is going to go where it makes commercial companies money.
And it's not just visually impaired people who driverless cars, if they ever appear on our roads, is going to have an impact on, is it, Robin?
No, we're just going to go along with the... we're going to jump on that train, excuse the cross metaphor, along with everybody else that's just going to be digging it, because they won't, you know, have to have their own their own vehicle, they won't have to pay for extreme, you know, extortionate prices for parking in inner cities, they won't have all the hassle of finding a parking space, all that sort of thing.
What kind of other disabled people could benefit? What other people with disabilities... What kind of disabilities are going to be, you know, helped by this?
People with severe learning difficulties, severe motor difficulties. Obviously, there's a lot you can do to adapt a car, but the freedom of being able to call one, and as long as you can sort of manipulate yourself into that vehicle or somebody can assist you, there's a broad range of people who would potentially benefit. I do think, though, as far as the time frame, the implementation, it's not going to be an all or nothing thing. I think that we will see over the next few years, as we are already, cars becoming more and more autonomous, you know, additional features coming on that make them closer and closer to that full autonomous mode or capability.
So you, the freedom of the open road, just doesn't appeal.
Well, I think my retinitis pigmentosa could, in 10 years, I could have a treatment for dealing with that first. That is real driving when you're using your eyes. It's like a sport, isn't it? It's that you're interacting with your environment. And that, I think, is what we mean by driving. I think sitting in a vehicle and being driven is not driving. It is using a vehicle as a taxi. And I really still struggle to see the difference between calling up a taxi and getting to your destination and what these vehicles are. These vehicles are the same thing.
But what appeals to me is the independence. Don't think I'd ever want to own a driverless car, but I would love to have a licence so I could just go and hire one and, I don't know, drive around France and if I wanted to.
It's more expensive,
I don't know. It's the romance. Well, OK, so you do drive.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I'm sure with your disability and the fact that you can drive, that independence is massive for you.
It's absolutely... It was life-changing when I passed my test at 17, more so than it was for my peers, I guess, because it meant that all of a sudden I could go where I wanted to without having mum and dad waiting there. You know, lots of my friends would walk to wherever they wanted to go, they'd get the bus and then they'd walk at the other end, and I could never do that. Mm. So being able to just hop in my car whenever I wanted to, it doesn't apply so much in London because people, you know, public transport is everywhere. But, you know, when you live in the country especially, you need that independence. You need to be able to get around. Is that something you find, Ryan?
Yeah. I'm from, like, a really small town in Missouri. I passed my driver's test when I was 16, and that was a big moment for me as well. A lot of freedom, I guess. So I do feel that, you know, having my license, even though I don't drive here, I just find having it, it gives me a sense of pride and, like, just freedom.
Completely.
I want driverless cars to be like hotel rooms. I want to call them cartels, where you basically... Well, it doesn't even have a seat or a steering wheel. You climb in and it's literally a bed,
like
a minibar.
Yeah, I mean...
Driving where you want to go,
I can do lots of short journeys, but long journeys are a real problem for me. So I often get the train because driving for more than an hour, just pain and fatigue is too much. But if I could get in a car that once I got outside of London, I could swivel around, put my head down, have a nap, wake up and I'm pretty much there. That is the dream.
Yeah. So sorry, Hugh. I feel like we've given you a hard time on this.
The thing is, I'm not worried about this because
the cure for your vision is going to come before driverless cars do, don't you?
Two things. Yeah, I do. I think that the next generation coming up underneath us with my particular eye condition, which is RP, I think their future is going to be very different. I think the way sight loss occurs is changing. And that's because of medical advances. And, you know, we're not factoring in medical advances here. And this point about what driving is, I mean, you've been saying about driving, your driver's license gives you a sense of pride. These are social factors. Our society, and thanks to Margaret Thatcher and other people who bigged up the cars, another guy I won't mention, he bigs up cars, gets in a lot of trouble for it. Won't mention him around this table, but cars are adulated by our society. That is a problem if you have difficulties getting around, because let's face it, getting around with a disability is difficult if you can't get a driver's license. But if you can, and you can use a wheelchair, for example, in your car, I could totally understand why that is completely liberating. But what is liberation? Is liberation having sufficient personal independence payment to be able to get taxis to where you need to go? Or is it driverless cars? Which one is it?
I would also say, though, that, you know, these autonomous vehicles would sort of see the end of car ownership to a large extent, would be in a form of public transport, really. You know, we're not talking about the devil car, which is privately owned. You know, these are going to be shared, they're going to be fully utilised. And I mean, I'm too holding out for a pair of bionic eyes, I think is what I would need to sort of sort out my lack of vision. But that they will come as well, and we could have a whole section on those. But as far as, for example, blind people being able to drive, to actually literally drive, I mean, the NFB, the National Federation for the Blind in America, a couple of years ago now, had a competition where they kitted up a lot of these NASCAR racing cars and they drove them around the track giving haptic feedback. Mm. They had all the autonomous stuff, but instead of actually driving the car, it sent information to to a blind driver, and depending on which finger got the vibration, you could turn the steering wheel that little bit more, and if you got a little jerk on your back, then you had to press the brake. That scares the life out of me, bringing a human back into the equation. So yes, they would be doing the driving, but if they were on the road, that I would be 100 miles away.
And if anyone's unsure, anyone listening about what NASCAR is, it's essentially a version of motor racing in the very popular in the deep south of America.
But no offence, Rob, but if you were to get into a car and say, come on, Kate, you know, climb in the car with me, I would say, no way.
I knew you were going to say that. That is such a cliche.
Not a chance.
That is such a cliche.
Why? Yeah.
Because if I was to say that to you, saying, I'd come across as so
because
sexist.
You're
no,
assuming,
but I can drive, you know?
You're assuming that Robin won't be able to, he'll be in that car unable to drive. That's your assumption.
No, well, I'm talking to Rob rather than Robin.
Yeah, I think we should keep computers in the equation and keep the human factor out of it as much as possible if we're going to try and achieve that really safe, really democratic.
And also, let's assume that Kate, from having spoken to her before, she doesn't like anybody driving her around.
I don't like
anyone.
I like to drive myself.
She's in control.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, that's what's behind all of that.
Okay, great. Well, Hugh and Robin, we have loved this discussion. Thank you very much for your time. But
stay with us.
Please don't go anywhere, because coming up, we've got... That's Hulkenberg, an alternative rock band from Bedford. Find out their disability connection when we hear this track in full at the end of the show. Now, Craig Green is 34 and the manager of a YMCA gym in Peterborough. His sport is cycling and he's hoping to make it to the Paralympics in Rio next year. But just 2 years ago, he wasn't a cyclist, and the year before that, he was in prison serving a 4-year sentence. Now, we mentioned earlier that, Craig, you have Poland syndrome. What does that mean for you?
It affects my right hand and I'm missing a pectoral muscle on my right hand side. So it has very little effect, if I'm honest. Possibly did when I was younger, but my memory's not great. So, not too much effect.
Why was it difficult when you were younger?
Kids are harsh. They say nasty things and you tend to listen.
And I hope you don't mind me saying, but your right hand is not as well formed. Is that the right thing to say?
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. Yeah, my right hand is missing fingers.
Well, it sounds like you've had quite a journey in that short amount of time over the last 3 or 4 years. So let's talk about your cycling first. Yep. How did you get into it, and how did the Paralympics hear about you?
I just finished London Marathon 2013, and I was on Twitter just trying to get a bit more sponsorship from, I think you had like a deadline of a couple of months afterwards to raise the money that you'd said you're going to raise.
So you ran the London Marathon?
I ran the London Marathon, yes, wow. For the YMCA, and I was just sort of plugging it on Twitter, and I come across a Paralympics like sports event the following weekend called Sportsfest, and what they do, it's run by Paralympic GB, and they basically showcase Paralympic events all over the country, and this one was in Sheffield. So I popped along to that and met up with British Cycling and British Triathlon. I was unsure of which I wanted to do. There was a power bike with British Cycling, so I done a 3-minute fitness test, which hurt, and a 6-second power test, and then come away from that with, do you fancy it? And yes, I do. Why not? Yeah, and that got the ball rolling.
You seem like you weren't that surprised when they said, yeah, you've got what it takes.
Well, there's nothing wrong with my legs, so...
Yeah, but there's nothing wrong with my legs, but I'm not going to be a Paralympian anytime soon.
Well, that's because you're not training to be a Paralympian soon. You're a radio host. I mean, I'm not a radio host, but give me 6 months and I might have your job, so I don't... But
it might be less than that. It might be 6 days.
But what I'm saying is I've always played a good level of sport most of my life, so when you see some of the people that I'm racing against and in competition with, there's no surprise that I'm doing well, because, again, there's nothing wrong with my legs. I might have some handling issues on the bike, but apart from that...
So let's take you back 5 years ago then.
Yeah.
And you went to prison for...
I did.
Cultivating drugs, is that right?
Yes, cultivating a Class B drug, which was cannabis, yeah.
So tell me about what it was like in prison. What led you there in the first place then? Tell me how it happened.
Well, I got involved with growing cannabis. When I say we, there was five or six of us. We started small, and it over the next 2 years it evolved into something that we didn't envision it, or didn't really think it was going to go that far, and it did. And then one day the police come through the door. So in a nutshell, without boring too many people for too long, that's pretty much, we got involved in something, it grew bigger and bigger and bigger, and then finally, and rightly so, I was arrested.
What did it feel like when the police came through the door?
Oh, I felt 5 stone lighter. It was pure relief.
Really?
Yeah.
You felt trapped in
a little bit, yeah.
This,
I was smoking cannabis. So the first month or so, like the honeymoon period, was great. It was a dream job for me, but reality set in and I was living two lives. I was lying to my partner and pretending I was working on a building site or a bit of construction work when obviously I was there every day. So, yeah, it's not nice to lie to people that you love, but I didn't want to get anybody else involved in case they were part of it as a conspiracy. So I kept it to myself and I would have took it to the grave. So,
why didn't you just leave if you felt uncomfortable and unhappy doing what you were doing?
I don't think anybody had a choice, really. I mean, I certainly didn't feel like I had a choice. I mean, I certainly didn't know who I was working for, so...
You felt there'd be retribution?
Yes, 100%, yeah.
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 Tell me a bit about when you got arrested. Did the police take your disability into account in any way, shape or form? Was that ever talked about or brought up?
Well, they cuffed me and I got out the cuffs.
Because your hand's not...
I didn't. No, not at all. I broke the law, and there was no reason to treat me any differently. I was a criminal, and and rightly so. I was arrested. So no, I didn't certainly weren't. Oh, I'm a blue badge holder, or you know. So
you didn't use it to your advantage in any way. You don't think?
No. Yeah. I don't think they would have listened. So it would just fell on deaf ears, wouldn't it?
And then when you went to prison, was that again? Was there any difference for you because you had a disability? Did you get extra food or not have to do certain duties? I don't know what it's like in prison. I'm just fascinated of, can you not use it to your advantage?
No, not particularly. No. I got one glove. Maybe that saved them on some money. I don't know. It was I was just treated as another number and another prisoner. So there was no, I wasn't treated any differently.
And what did the prisoners think about you while you were in there? Did anyone sort of notice that you were a bit different? Did you ever...
I think there's a lot of people in there that are a bit different. So, no, I don't think so. The first 3 weeks was a bit of a blur, so I might have. I just might not have noticed. But, no, our story was quite a big one, and it was on the TV. So when I turned up with my co-defendants, people knew straight away.
You were famous.
Well, yeah, but not the way I'd wanted. But I wasn't treating any differently.
And now you're manager of a gym.
Yep.
Now as well. So, I mean, we often hear a lot about how difficult it is for people with previous convictions to get work. I mean, you must have really impressed someone. How did it come about for you to get back into the workplace again?
Well, my boss right now, Julie Martin, she actually come into the prison. And I was eligible for release on temporary licence, which means I got my 4-year sentence, I had served 2. But after a year, you have an eligibility date, so you're able to go home, whether you've obviously you've got to meet the criteria. If I didn't behave myself and was getting in trouble inside, it wouldn't have happened. So I was eligible to get a work in Rottle, so released on temporary licence, and home leave. And I met my boss now when I was working in the gym in the prison. And I was released on a Monday, a Wednesday and a Thursday to the YMCA gym that I now run. So that's how it come about.
Now, I mean, you're taking part in Ride London, aren't you?
I am, yeah.
Yeah, then that's all in aid of scope.
That is for scope, yeah.
Yeah.
There's more places as well if anybody else wants to do it.
And you said you're currently waiting on, it'll be September when you'll find out if you're going to make it to Rio as part of Team GB.
About the end of the season, yeah.
So what do you have to do to make sure you get into the team? What's next?
Oh, there's a lot of factors. There's results, obviously, speak volumes. There's, I suppose, being liked or getting on with people. But generally, British Cycling will get allocated a certain amount of places for Rio in my category. So there's all sorts of factors, but ultimately, if I do well this season, impress not only nationally but internationally, then there's nothing stopping me, really. And I've entered some European World Cups and I'm going to do what I can when I can and obviously 100%.
So do you think you're going to make it?
Yeah, I do. I've thought this since day one. The problem is that the closer we're getting, the further I seem to be getting away, because time's obviously running out and sponsors and stuff. But, yeah, I fully think I've got what it takes to make that seat on that plane. Yeah,
it's an amazing story, and
so
thank
exciting.
You so much for coming in, and yeah, very
thank
best
you.
Of luck,
thank
and we'll,
you
and we'll obviously keep everybody involved, and we'll find out if you do make it onto the team in September, and we wish you the very best of luck. Now, do stay with us. Craig will be staying with us. I've just told you. I should have asked, really. He'll be staying with us till the end of the programme. You're listening to Ouch. It's Disability Talk from the BBC. Robin Christofferson and Hugh Huddy are with us still. And now it's time to say hello to Ryan Branson. Hello, Ryan.
Hello.
Now, Ryan's 25, and you've battled anorexia nervosa since you were a teenager.
Yeah.
Now, you can read a blog about his experiences. It's at bbc.co.uk/ouch. Now, Ryan, you're a unique case, I guess, because not only are you a man who's had eating disorders, you know, which is something we tend to hear more about from women, but you also have cerebral palsy,
right.
Walk with a frame, use a mobility scooter.
Right.
And now you're from Missouri, but studying here in London on a master's degree in eating disorders and nutrition, is that right?
Right, yeah.
I think I've done your full bio there. Now, can you pinpoint when your difficulties with food started?
It's hard to say a specific time point, but I always seem to think it started when I was either 15 or 16. You know, because I was entering high school at the time, and, you know, high school is a time where people judge you, and if you don't fit, it's the typical stereotype. I mean, you kind of get shut out.
Well, so, what stereotype is that?
Well, I went to a very small public school. I was pretty much the only disabled kid there. So I stood out, you know, obviously.
When you say public school, in Britain we'd call that a regular state school, as in no fees or anything like that.
Right.
Is that right?
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
right.
Okay, sorry. Yeah, carry
right.
on.
Yeah, I think it's just, you know, I walked different, and that was enough to kind of make me an outcast for a better, you know, in the eyes of everyone else. Yeah, it wasn't a good time.
And did you feel that food, in a way, became as much of an enemy as your classmates, who were obviously giving you a hard time?
Pretty much. You know, cerebral palsy, you know, it's not something you can really control. It's there. You just have to deal with it. Food, it became something, you know, you can control. You can control what you eat and how much you eat. And also being, you know, constantly looked at for being different. I was aware that people were constantly, you know, looking at me, not just in school, but just out in public, because I'm easy to spot, I guess. So, yeah, I became really aware of my body, and I didn't want that to be another thing for people to criticize me about.
So you felt that by diminishing the amount of food you ate, you would somehow become less conspicuous as a man in a small town in Missouri?
Yeah, I kind of actually felt in a way that I wanted to disappear. And, you know, I felt when you don't eat and I kept losing weight, you obviously become smaller. So I do feel that just wanting to kind of get away from everything and just kind of, you know, go in my own little world and not have to deal with people criticizing me. And also, I think for a long time, due to my mobility, even though I'm not fully not able to move, I became really conscious of my calorie intake because I worried a lot about not burning off calories and putting on weight. And I kind of feel that's probably...
You felt because you had CP, you weren't moving as much as other people were,
yeah,
therefore you weren't burning off the calories. Right,
right, right.
Yeah.
And it became really bad where no matter what kind of food I ate, no matter how many calories it had, I felt compelled I had to burn off every single one.
I totally see that because as regular listeners will know, I am always on a diet because I'm always aware of how much food, you know, I eat compared to how much I burn. And this new flipping iPhone, I tell you, it counts your steps. And I look at my steps and, like, you know, it's like 200 steps a day or something. And it's telling me you have to get to 10,000. And I just think, I'm never going to be able to get to 10,000. How the heck do I burn off enough calories as a you know, quote unquote normal person?
Exactly.
It's that kind of pressure, isn't it, I guess, that you were feeling.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's just really hard, and it just becomes an obsession, really, of counting everything you eat and trying to get rid of it.
And so. you got really poorly, didn't you?
Yeah, I got down to a really low weight. Had to be admitted into hospital, did inpatient treatment for a while, was on bed rest. So, I got pretty bad.
And what was it like being an inpatient? And I assume you had to do therapy. And was that quite... Did you feel supported there? Or did you feel like people didn't understand because you were a male in this sort of more female environment, I guess?
I was definitely outnumbered. Certain places, treatment centers, are trying to become more aware of males possibly being there and kind of catering to their specific needs. But I did feel that a lot of it was still catered to females.
How long did it take you to redevelop eating patterns that wouldn't make you ill?
Well, I was in hospital for probably 6 weeks. Then I had to start outpatient therapy. And that went on for a few months, actually. But I wouldn't even say I was totally better by the end of that. It's really, you know, in my opinion, it's really a lifelong struggle. Mm. You get to a point where you can positively cope with it. But at least in my experience, there's always that little voice in the back of my head that says, okay, you ate this, you know, you don't want to put on weight, you
know. Yeah, so I mean, if I were to put a piece of cake in front of you, and myself, because, you know, nobody should eat cake alone.
It's never stopped you.
True. How would you feel about that piece of cake in front of you? What would be going through your mind?
Well, depending what kind of cake.
Velvet.
Not a big fan of that. Let's try chocolate cake.
Nice, good choice.
I mean, I've come to a point where I'm really not scared to eat food. I'm just still very aware, you know, of what's in it. But I would eat the cake. I mean, I can't let you eat cake alone.
man after my own heart. Do you find yourself kind of constantly thinking of, you know, have your thought processes sort of amended themselves, or do you think you're still in that thing of?
No, they definitely improved a whole lot better. I mean, I'm in this field as a career, or that's what I want to do. So it has to get to a certain point where you're able to, you know, live and it not be this obsession. I will say that I'm still aware of it, but I've realized that just because you eat something, you're constantly burning off calories, even if you're just sitting here, for your brain to function.
It's interesting what we're saying about obviously anorexia being a disability that we tend to associate more with women. I mean, does that, the fact that you have had this issue with anorexia as a man, I mean, what does that do to your sense of masculinity?
Well, in the media, it's portrayed at times as manorexia, which I find quite sexist, actually.
Yeah, it's an awful term, isn't it?
I don't think it really hurt my masculinity that much. I mean, because I just feel that, you know, it's a disease. It's what I have. I happen to be a guy with it. I really don't see how it's shameful to me. I mean, I'm, like, very open about my experience. And I know that's different from a lot of other men. They're very quiet and don't like to be open with people.
Yeah.
But I just feel like I've gone through it. You can't change that. You just have to learn from it and go on. And I feel that I want to use my experience to help other men with it because I know how hard of a time it is. And I just feel I need to use it to my advantage,
yeah,
because it happened. So,
I mean, Hugh and Craig, do you guys feel any less masculine because of your disability? And Robin, of course, down the line. Craig, sure. It looks like you're desperate to jump in here.
I totally can see where Ryan's coming from, and I obsess massively about eating. and the obviously line of work I'm in, I see all sorts, and from people wanting to lose weight to people wanting to put on muscle. So I see both ends of the spectrum. But me personally, I wouldn't eat that cake. I fall out with people at work all the time for, do not bring me cake in, bring me fruit, bring me something that you know I'm going to have. My birthday last week and I had so much cake brought in. I mean, you know what I'm like. If I'm rude, you're having that back. I'm sorry. Someone else is going to eat it on my behalf. I'm not eating that cake.
Why not, though?
There's just something about a load of cakes in a gym.
Just don't eat cake, and it's not a good advertisement for the gym. And if my little girl, Millie, makes me a cake, I'll eat that cake. But if we're out and everyone's having pudding, I won't be having pudding because I don't need it. I've ate what I wanted to eat. And if that takes my masculinity away, then so be it. But I would like to be lighter and keep my leg muscle. So I'm in a fight the whole time with my diet.
What about you, Hugh and Robin?
When I was 18 and I sort of knew that my sight condition was you know, probably going to deteriorate to the point where I wouldn't be able to function as a kind of get away with pretending to be a sighted person, I took to the gym. I joined a gym in Marple in Cheshire where I grew up, and I became completely obsessed with bodybuilding.
Is that because of your masculinity?
Well, yeah, I think it was actually, and well, no, I don't think it was actually. It definitely was. Let's just be frank about it.
You felt your sight being impeded meant that you felt less masculine.
Yeah, I know, it wasn't that I felt less masculine. It was that I needed to power up.
Right.
I think that's a totally different thing. I needed to feel that if people saw me and thought, oh, he's that guy I can't see, but they said, but he's physically he's a very powerful-looking person. Mm. That compensates more in a way because it's a sign that you're looking after yourself, that you're competing with yourself, you're overcoming. And I, that sport, sort of that urge to athletically develop myself probably took me into the serious rowing I did because I was in the adaptive rowing squad in 2003, then became the Paralympic rowing squad. So I competed internationally in rowing. Wow. And I think that was because there was this sense in me, it always has been there, that my body is, I fight with it. I want to discipline it. And food, it's incredible what you were saying about food because I've always thought of food as, cake and stuff as something it's not that I shouldn't be eating it, it's just it's not, I don't need it. Yeah. Why am I eating it? It's not going to turn me into the person I want to be.
Mm. And Robin, how about you?
Well, for me, kind of as a side effect of my disability, not directly related to it, my masculinity has always been slightly not quite what I would have chosen to be. But so basically, when I was a teenager, I was on huge doses of steroids to try and combat the inflammation in my retinas and save some vision. And that was over the sort of growth years. So it started at 13 and I basically never grew again. So this is me at 13, basically. And so I do weights and stuff like that to kind of sort of, compensate to a certain extent. Mm. But my masculinity has been given a bit of a boost by proxy over the last sort of 6 months or so, because my son, who's now 13, has shot up way past me. He's like nearly 6 foot now. And I mean, I'm only 5'8". I'm not sort of a dwarf or anything. But so I'm thinking to myself, I mean, I've never mentioned this to anyone else, but I'm thinking to myself internally at least, that's me. That I would have been that, if it wasn't for the so, I can feel like, well, I had the genes, but I just had a slight, restraining factor along the way. But yeah, it's nice to see my son. I mean, his voice is twice as deep as mine, and it's nice that he's going to, go places where I would have gone if it hadn't been for the
fruit of your loins, etc. Yeah.
Well,
it seems that, Craig, you mentioned your daughter as well. I mean, surely having children, what bigger sign of masculinity can there be than being able to reproduce? I mean, that must help, surely, with these issues of masculinity that we've been discussing.
I've never had any issues with masculinity at all. I'm not saying I'm the most masculine man in the world. That's far from it. But obviously having what helps with me with my children is a goal and a vision and a better future. So that's what gets me going through the tough training sessions and the early mornings, late nights. So that's how my kids play a role, and I've got two of them. So
yeah, I'm doing the Hackney Half Marathon in May, and I know in myself, I want my son who's five and my daughter who's two, I want them to see their dad physically competing in something that's, you know, I'm no longer am I anywhere near sort of Craig's level of athletic performance. But for me, you know, my years were 10 years ago when I was competing. But now it's, I want them to see it's part of the daily thing. You train, you keep that, yourself fit. And I want them to see this.
I can see that. And, you know, I think it's good for you guys who have disabilities that do allow you to be physically active. But I guess, Ryan, for you, that you're not able to go and do this training, you're not able to go and build muscle, you're not able to go and run a half a marathon. Do you find that impacts your masculinity?
Well, I am able to, you know, do basic weightlifting. Actually, back when I was like 17, when I was officially diagnosed with my anorexia, I was in a state of obsessive exercising, mainly doing weight training.
Do you like your body now?
If I'm being honest, I mean, I've never been, you know, totally fine with it. I mean, it's definitely improved to a point where I'm not obsessing over it. I don't know if I'd ever say that, you know, I love my body. I'm not that conceited, but I don't love my body, but, like, can anyone really say they love their body?
I would be worried if people said, I adore my own body.
I would
really worry about narcissists drowning them in the lake. I mean, do men love their bodies? I mean, I've never met a man who said that.
From my point of view, you know, growing up, knowing that I'd lose all my vision, I could never assume that I would meet somebody and the sort of dream about meeting someone, getting married, having kids and that sort of thing. And to me, that was never something that I could take for granted. So, you know, being married and having kids, that to me is all the confirmation that I need. So the fact that my wife likes my body, that's all that matters. And I think, you know, for people that can attain that, or a long-term partner, or whoever it might be, a significant other, that does no end of good for your sort of personal image.
Well, I'm going to ask you now to all start thinking about your brain muscles rather than your brawn for a moment, as it's time with grim inevitability for the Ouch Monthly Quiz. We're going to test you all on disability news stories you've soaked up, Kate.
Yep, do not fear. It's not too challenging this month. I'm sure you'll all be able to jump in. So, first question. The first ever racing car driver with a disability has joined the British Touring Car Championships. His name is Nicholas, and he has a famous Formula One brother. Who is his brother?
Just shout out if you know the answer.
Is it Jenson Button?
Oh, no. I mean, there's not many options left.
Hill.
No, not Damon Hill. Come on, guys. Surely everyone knows this.
Mansell.
He's pretty much the most famous racing driver in the world right now.
Right now.
Right now. Vettel? Vettel?
No.
Vettel.
British?
Right now. Oh, Hamilton.
Yeah.
Of course it is. Of course it is.
God, yep. Like dragging a baby calf out of a pregnant cow. That was, yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, Nicholas Hamilton's famous brother is Lewis Hamilton. Nicholas has been given guest status for the season, but will not be eligible to score any championship points.
So, next question. A survey by Great with Disability has found that more than three quarters of disabled students and graduates are afraid of what? Any guesses?
Stairs.
That's a good guess.
Discrimination.
Good guess,
I like that.
Do we mean stairs that you climb up, or stairs as in visual stairs?
Climb up. Curves.
Employment discrimination.
Yeah. What was that?
Oh, Robin.
What employment, did you? Employment discrimination.
Yeah, you're bang on.
Close enough.
Yeah, close enough. I'm going to give you that. They're afraid of disclosing the fact that they are disabled to potential employees.
Do you know what?
There was application stage.
There was a really interesting thing very quickly. Even Break, who try and champion disabled people into work, they did a bit of desk research. They applied for 20 vacancies. They put the CVs, the covering letter, etc., and they didn't tick the box that said, I've got a disability. Then they did the exact same 20, the same CVs, the same covering letters. They just changed the names each time, and they did tick the box. In the first instance, they got 20 responses. In the second, they got zero.
Whoa.
So that's the kind of... I'm not surprised.
That's the kind of thing that makes me want to go off and have a large whiskey. This is so depressing.
Do you guys tick the box when it says on applications, when it says do you have a disability? Would you tick?
Well, obviously, me and Kate did for this show. But that's slightly different.
That's the problem. I think
depends on the messaging you get from the employer.
Yeah, it depends on that employer's attitude. If they see disability as diversity and advantage, then I would. But if I'm not sure I'd even want to work for a company that decided that disability wasn't something for them. I don't think that'd be
Should the question even be on a form? Quite frankly,
there's a really good website called cleartalents.com, which is a third-party place where people can go and independently disclose right across the 9 protected characteristics, so race, religion, sex, gender, etc. And that then tells the employer, the potential employer, what adjustments they need to make at each stage during the application process. So that is the only way I know of getting around this sort of catch-22, cleartalents.com.
Ryan, do you tick that box?
I would, because I feel like, you know, at least with me, it's pretty obvious, my disability. So I feel like I'd be starting off at a bad point because I'm being dishonest with a potential employer, and that's not a good way to start off any relationship. Mm. And I do feel that, at least in America, I feel like a lot of companies are becoming more, you know, diverse, and they actually might want to hire a disabled person because that, you know, that helps that particular company kind of with their image, per se, that they're more open to disabled employees, and that can generate good press, I guess. And,
Craig, which is worse to tick? The tick box that says you've got a disability or the tick box that says you've got a criminal record?
Both. You're unemployable. No, I don't know. Surely a criminal record. I mean, I don't know the statistics, but
it's pretty rubbish that we're having to compare the two, isn't it?
There's so many people out there with disabilities, and companies have got to hire a certain amount of people with disabilities. Definitely a criminal record is worse, I'd say. And I have to tick both, so good job I've got a job.
And long may it continue.
Well, Craig Green, Ryan Branson, Hugh Huddy and Robin Christofferson, thank you all for taking part today. Thanks to the Ouch team, Emma Tracy, Kathleen Hawkins and studio manager Rob Winter. Our producer was Damon Rose.
If you subscribe to our podcast feed via bbc.co.uk/ouch, you can hear the team in our new mini podcast throughout the month. Kate and I will be back for an hour-long show in May.
As always, we play music at the end, and this month it's from a band called Hulkenberg, an alternative rock duo from Bedford. Its members Michael Waugh and Terry Roughhead describe themselves as hairy degenerates with nothing to lose, and that their song contains no beauty, no truth, no subtlety, no compromise, just beards and brutality, riffs and mayhem. God, that's a mouthful.
That's the most NME-friendly little biog I've ever heard in my life.
But why are we playing them, Rob? What is the disability connection?
Okay, drum roll, please. Terry is the disabled one, and he has, let me see if I can pronounce this, Charcot-Marie Tooth. Is that right?
No idea.
It's a neurological condition anyway. He works with Attitude Is Everything, which aims to facilitate accessibility for disabled audiences and performers at music events.
You can find links to Hulkenberg's website from our blog bbc.co.uk/ouch. Now here's one side of their latest AA single, it's Mathemagicians. Goodbye. I try to
to be a better present for you and for me, but I've been all so terribly weak and my knees are months at sea. And now the sins of the brother or the sins of the son, the more I try and hold it together, the more I cannot.